From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
45 minutes we rocked in silence, and the therapist told us after Jeff died that that was no doubt his last place of refuge, his last safe harbor that he felt they could go to.
Kevin Lucy's son, Lance Corporal Jeffrey Lucy, committed suicide after returning from Iraq. Today, Kevin and his wife, Joyce, are suing the Veterans Administration for negligence in their son's death. We spend the hour with the Lucys hearing their story. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Defense Secretary Robert Gates have arrived in Egypt as part of their Middle East trip aimed at uniting Arab allies against Iran. On Monday, the U.S. officially announced plans to give military aid worth more than $43 billion to Saudi Arabia, Israel, Egypt, and other Gulf states in an effort to boost its Middle East allies against Iran. Iran responded to the arms deal by accusing the United States of trying to further destabilize the Middle East. This is Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mohammad Ali Hosseini.
America has always considered one policy in this region, and that is creating fear and concerns in the countries of the region and trying to harm the good relation between these countries, and making an effort to create a chance to sell its arms and impose the export of these arms to countries in the region.
Condoleezza Rice dismissed Iran's critique. She said, quote, "There isn't a doubt Iran constitutes the single most important single country strategic challenge to the United States and to the kind of the Middle East we want to see." Britain's new Prime Minister Gordon Brown met with President George Bush on Monday at Camp David. Brown appeared to fully defend the so-called U.S. war on terror.
"We know we are in a common struggle, and we know we have to work together, and we know we've got to use all means to deal with it. So we are at one in fighting the battle against terrorism, and that struggle is one that we will fight with determination and with resilience and right across the world."
President Bush praised Gordon Brown's vision.
"The notion of America and Britain sharing values is very important, and that we have an obligation, it seems to me, to work for freedom and justice around the world. And I found a person who shares that vision and who understands the call. After all, we're writing the initial chapters of what I believe is a great ideological struggle between those of us who do believe in freedom and justice and human rights and human dignity, and cold-blooded killers who will kill innocent people to achieve their objectives."
During a press briefing, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown was also asked about Iran and Darfur.
"On Iran, we are in agreement that sanctions are working, and the next stage we are ready to move towards is to toughen the sanctions with a further UN resolution. Darfur is the greatest humanitarian disaster the world faces today, and I've agreed with the President that we step up our pressure to end the violence that has displaced 2 million people, made 4 million hungry and reliant on food aid, and murdered 200,000 people."
On Capitol Hill, the move to impeach Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is gaining steam. Democratic Congressmember Jay Inslee of Washington is expected to introduce a resolution today directing the House Judiciary Committee to investigate whether to impeach Gonzalez. Both Democratic and Republican lawmakers have accused Gonzalez of lying to Congress to cover up for actions of the Bush administration. Inslee said, quote, "It's indefensible to treat the truth with such cavalier disregard when talking to the American people and Congress." FBI and IRS agents have raided the home of Republican Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska. The 83-year-old Stevens is the longest-serving Republican in the Senate's history and considered one of the most powerful Republicans on Capitol Hill. He served as chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee for 6 years. The raid is connected to a widespread corruption probe surrounding the Alaskan-based oil pipeline service company, Veeco Corporation. Last August, the FBI and IRS raided the offices of several Alaskan state lawmakers, including Senator Stevens' son, State Senate President Ben Stevens. In May, three current and former state lawmakers were arrested on bribery charges. 3 days later, Veeco's CEO Bill Allen and the company's vice president pleaded guilty to extortion, bribery, and conspiracy to impede the Internal Revenue Service. Allen had been one of Senator Stevens' closest political allies. Contractors have told a federal grand jury that in 2000, VECO executives, including Allen, oversaw a lavish remodeling of Stevens' home. Since then, VECO's received more than $30 million in federal contracts. The Wall Street Journal reported last week that Alaska's sole congressman, Republican Don Young, is also being investigated as part of the criminal inquiry. Chief Justice John Roberts has been hospitalized after suffering a seizure at his vacation home in Maine. The 52-year-old Roberts fell on a boat dock during the seizure and suffered minor scrapes. Doctors said the incident was a benign idiopathic seizure, meaning they found no tumor, stroke, or other explanation. Roberts had a similar seizure in 1993. The American Civil Liberties Union has issued a warning about a little-noticed executive order recently signed by President Bush. The executive order authorizes the Treasury Department to freeze and confiscate the assets of anyone connected to the Iraq insurgency. But the ACLU says the order contains sweeping provisions that pose risks for residents of the United States and for humanitarian workers in Iraq. The order allows the Treasury Department to freeze the funds of anyone who indirectly threatens the peace or stability of Iraq or who undermines efforts to promote economic reconstruction and political reform. Jamil Jaffer of the ACLU said, quote, "This executive order reaches far beyond criminal activity to activity that may be entirely innocent. A person may find herself inadvertently in violation of this order, and there's no provision for judicial review." A recent Washington Post article on the issue began with this sentence, quote, "Be careful what you say and whom you help, especially when it comes to the Iraq war and the Iraqi government." ABC News is reporting the FBI is recruiting thousands of undercover informants to help the agency spy inside the United States. According to a recent unclassified report to Congress, the FBI wants to build a network of more than 15,000 informants. ABC reports the aggressive push for more secret informants appears to be part of a new effort to grow its intelligence and counterterrorism efforts. Other recent proposals include expanding its collection and analysis of data on U.S. persons, retaining years' worth of Americans' phone records, and increasing so-called black bag secret entry operations. The European Union has agreed to cooperate with the United States on an airline security program that's been widely criticized by privacy groups. Under the agreement, airlines flying from Europe to the U.S. will be required to hand over detailed personal information on passengers. Depending on the circumstances, the information could include racial or ethnic origin, political opinions, religious or philosophical beliefs, data about an individual's health, traveling partner, sexual orientation, and whether the passenger is a member of a labor union. Airlines will not be required to collect this information about passengers, but any such information that exists in their reservation system will be shared. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff praised the pact as an essential screening tool. Chertoff said such a system would have helped uncover many of the 9/11 hijackers. Jim Dempsey of the Center for Democracy and Technology said, quote, "This is part of a broader trend of the government building databases on the ordinary lawful activities of ordinary law-abiding people." In Australia, an Indian-born doctor has been released from prison after being held for 25 days. Dr. Mohammed Hanif was detained after officials alleged he had provided material support to men who carried out the car bomb attacks in London and Glasgow last month. Hanif has not been implicated by British authorities in the attacks. After he was released from immigration detention, his work visa was revoked, forcing him to return to India. Australian Prime Minister John Howard has refused to apologize over his government's handling of the case. Dr. Hanif spoke to reporters in India on Monday.
I would like also mention the fact, in spite of Australian authorities mentioning that they're not going to apologize for me, I don't expect any apology from the Australian authorities or the Australian government. But I would definitely appreciate if they apologize for the peace leaving, for my peace leaving country and its citizens here.
Dr. Hanif's lawyer, Peter Russo, criticized how his client was treated.
The Australian Federal Police emptied every item of personal belongings out of his unit. He did not have anywhere to go back and live after their behavior. If that doesn't make a person feel like a victim of some sort, I don't know what would.
The Washington Post is reporting the first application to build a new U.S. nuclear power plant in 3 decades has been filed with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The Constellation Energy Group of Baltimore filed a partial application to build a third nuclear reactor at Calvert Cliffs in Lesby, Maryland. The site is about 50 miles from the nation's capital. This marks the first new application to build a nuclear power plant in the United States since before the partial meltdown at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania in 1979. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission expects a wave of new nuclear power plant applications in the near future. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports a one-sentence provision buried in the Senate's recently passed energy bill could make builders of new nuclear power plants eligible for tens of billions of dollars in government loan guarantees. The sentence was inserted without debate at the urging of the nuclear power industry. In Belgium, the story of an 11-year-old girl from Ecuador is making headlines today, less than 24 hours after she was released from an immigration jail. The girl, Angelica Cajamarca, had been detained since late June. She was scheduled to be deported to Ecuador along with her mother because they were undocumented immigrants. But after public outcry in both Ecuador and Belgium, a Belgian court ordered the deportation stopped. The family lawyers had told the court the detention was inhuman and traumatizing for Angelica, adding the girl's detention goes against the European Convention of Human Rights and the International Convention on Children's Rights. After she was released, Angelica spoke to the press.
I'm really happy because I'm with my dad now, with all my family and my brother. It was very bad. It was bad, bad. And when they took us to the airport, they harmed us. They harmed my mom. They knocked and pushed. I learned to be strong and to fight all the bad things people do. I learned to be strong.
The family's lawyer said their fight is only beginning. They're still subject to order to leave Belgium. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. When Americans opposed to war call for a cutoff of funding, the administration responds they don't support the troops. But a growing number of veterans groups and military families are saying it's the administration that's deserted the troops. Last week, two major lawsuits were filed that could put the administration's treatment of veterans on trial. A class action suit on behalf of hundreds of thousands of soldiers accuses the Department of Veterans Affairs of ignoring veterans' mental health care and overzealously denying medical care and benefits. The plaintiffs are two veterans groups, Veterans for Common Sense and Veterans United for Truth. They say returning soldiers are denied care through outright rejection or the long waiting process and a backlog of some 600,000 pending claims. The suit also accuses the VA of collaborating with the Pentagon to avoid paying benefits by classifying post-traumatic stress disorder claims as pre-existing conditions. Up to 800,000 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are said to suffer or risk developing PTSD. Just a day after the first suit was filed, the parents of a U.S. Marine who committed suicide after returning from Iraq filed a suit alleging government failure to treat veterans cost their son his life. Joyce and Kevin Lucy say their son Jeffrey hanged himself after the U.S. military refused to deal with his post-traumatic stress disorder. In May of 2004, Jeffrey's parents had him involuntarily committed to a VA hospital, but the hospital discharged him a few days later. 2 weeks later, Kevin Lucy came home to find his son hanging from a hose in the cellar. Lying on his bed were the dog tags of two unarmed Iraqi prisoners Jeffrey had said he was forced to shoot. The Lucys are suing the VA for negligence. On Monday, Joyce and Kevin Lucy joined me from Chicopee, Massachusetts, to talk about their son, Jeffrey, and the lawsuit they've brought over his death. Today, we spend the hour hearing their story. I began by asking Joyce Lucy about how her son went to Iraq.
Jeffrey went to Kuwait in beginning of February of 2003, into Iraq with the initial invasion in March. He returned home to us in July of 2003. And at the beginning, we didn't notice any major difference, although his girlfriend said he was distant when they went away for the weekend to Cape Cod. And he told a friend that he had seen enough sand to last him a lifetime, so he really didn't want to go on the beach. We found out during the fall that he was vomiting on a daily basis. We encouraged him to go to the doctor on that. And they went more for a physical reason rather than a psychological. And now looking back, it might have been the PTSD starting. And then He progressed on to Christmas Eve, where he threw the dog tags at his sister and called himself a murderer. From there to nightmares, which I heard him yelling out, and to which he said he was fine, that he was just having a dream that he was caught in an alleyway and they were coming after him. And then Jeffrey went back to college. He had been in college in September after his return, went back to college in January, and was fine until March when they have their college break. And at that point, he got very depressed, drinking, and couldn't go back to school, even though he didn't actually tell me that. But he would go and come home early and say class had ended earlier, the professor didn't show up. So I didn't really know he wasn't attending classes, but he was having panic attacks. And when he finally did say something, he said he just couldn't stay in class. And he was also having a startle response if somebody would slam a door. So he went to our primary care physician at that point and was put on Prozac and Ativan to see if it could keep him in class. And it just continued on from there. The inability to sleep, the lack of appetite, the social seclusion. Do you recall further?
He had a lot of different things. There was hallucinations that started with the visual, the audio, tactile. He would talk about hearing camel spiders in his room at night, and he actually had a flashlight under his bed for which he could use to search for the camel spiders. His whole life was falling apart, and it was very hard. And what also happened was that the family was being impacted tremendously, but we adapted to it. We didn't even recognize that we were going through our own horrors.
Kevin, Joyce said that at Christmas he threw the dog tags. What dog tags?
He threw the dog tags that his girlfriend had spoken to us about that concerned her. He had his dog tag. And then there was, from a story that Jeff shared with us, he had two other dog tags, Iraqi, that were from men that he said that he knew he killed. And he would never take those dog tags off. The only two times that we know the dog tags were taken off was on December 24th of 2003 when he threw them to at his sister. And then I found it on his bed on June 22nd, 2004, the day he died.
And do you know who these men were and what the circumstances were he said he killed them?
The story that he shared with myself and his sister, was basically that they were two unarmed Iraqi men and that he was in close proximity and somebody had told him to pull the trigger. And
somebody?
Yes, we don't know who. We don't know who. We don't know if it was a member of his unit or if it was an officer. We aren't sure. He never shared that with us. But what happened was that he did speak about how the gun was shaking when he did it, and he was looking at the young man, especially one of them, and he said, he said that it could have been him. It was a young man who he was wondering about whose son he was, whether he was father, his parents, and that was part of the emotional toll. His therapist came up to us afterwards and stated to us very directly that Jeff wore the dog tags to honor those two men that he knew he killed, not as trophies.
And these were Iraqis?
Yes. There was another agency that looked into it, and what they did was they were able to translate them. And it was a man from Babylon and a man from Baghdad.
As the months went by, Jeffrey started to wear his uniform on the street. Did he ever engage in combat when he came home or feel like he had to carry a gun around, protection?
No, the only time Jeffrey ever wore his uniform after he came back, that we're aware of anyway, is on, I believe it was June 12th. Mm-hmm. He climbed out his window around midnight, and he got in a car that our neighbors, a couple of the girls, were in, asked him to drive him to a place where he could get some liquor. And they were kind of scared because Jeffrey had a modified pellet gun and two K-bars on him. Jeffrey never wore his uniform. That was just so out of character. That wasn't my son. When he first joined the Marines, and I believe we had picked him up from boot camp, and it was like, I don't wear my uniform any place. That's just something we don't do. So that was totally out of character. And these girls did bring him home, and it was scary to see him get out of the car. He just didn't look like my son.
So talk about dealing with the VA and why you have sued the VA.
Well, I think that the primary reason is that what happened to Jeff should have never happened. Jeff was so afraid to go to the VA because he was afraid that the military would find out. And it's that stigma issue. And so therefore, we called anonymously and we described the symptoms. And they told us that that's classic PTSD and get him in as soon as possible. And what happened was Jeff finally did agree to go in, but he delayed it until May 28th on Friday. And when I was bringing Jeff to them, I really did think that we were bringing him to the arms of the angels because they were going to save him. They were going to deal with Jeff's problems. And it took us about 6 hours to get him committed. They tried to talk him to going in voluntarily, but Jeff refused to. So Jeff was finally committed, and he tried to leave the building, but the nursing staff and the police had to go after him, but they brought him back in. He was there for about 3.5 days. He was discharged on June 1st, and what we discovered, and this was about a year afterwards, that there was a psychiatrist that saw him upon the admission, and then there was a psychiatrist who saw him at the discharge, but no psychiatrist saw him at all during those two times.
You mean during the entire time he was committed, he was not seen by a psychiatrist except for being admitted and for being released?
Correct.
And it was two different psychiatrists, so there really was no continuity in the care.
And why did they release him?
Because he was not showing homicidal or suicidal ideations. He was coherent. She didn't think he was a threat to himself or others.
But during this time, Amy, we need to emphasize that Jeff had revealed to them three ways that he had planned to commit suicide. He told them that he would suffocate himself, he would overdose, or he would hang himself. He also shared with the psychiatrist how he had bought a hose. And of course, on the following of June 5th, when we tried to admit him the second time, and the VA declined, Joyce and I went through the house. We took everything that he could hurt himself with, but we never thought of a hose.
When did he tell them about this three ways he would commit suicide? Did he tell the admitting doctor or the one who released him a few days later?
It's in the records that he told the staff, I believe.
It was during that time.
I believe it was, what, was it Friday night?
But they didn't tell you.
Maybe.
No.
Joyce and Kevin Lucy, their son committed suicide June 22, 2004. We'll come back to their story after break.
Katie holds up the Bible. Baghdad. Soldiers, load up your guns and tie a ribbon around something. Something good has begun. Boy in the middle, he's
Lizzie West singing 19 Miles to Baghdad. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to our interview with Joyce and Kevin Lucey, they're suing the Veterans Administration for responsibility in their son's suicide. Lance Corporal Jeffrey Lucey took his own life after the VA denied him treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. On June 1, 2004, Jeffrey was released from a VA hospital after he'd been involuntarily committed by his family. I asked them to talk about that time after he was released.
He totaled the family car on Thursday, June 3rd, at, not by drinking. He landed between two trees. The police brought him home. They did a breathalyzer, and they said he was fine. Then on Saturday, his sister was graduating from a local college, and Jeffrey took his own car there. By the time he got there, he was totally impaired, barely able to walk. I believe it was a fire officer, was
yes.
It? Kind of guided him into where we were, and it was just a shock to see him come in. I thought, oh my God. And from that point, we went home to try to continue Debbie's graduation, and Jeffrey was, his balance was off. He was slurring his words. He was trying to borrow my mother's car to go buy his sister a gift. It was just, it was very difficult. So we called the VA and explained what was going on, and they said, he's worse than he was last week. He sounds worse than he was last week. Bring him right in. So after convincing Jeffrey, which it took a bit of time to get him into the car, he went back with my two daughters, my son-in-law, and my dad, because he didn't want my husband going, because he had been involuntarily committed the earlier weekend, and he felt that my husband might have had something to do with it. So they brought him there, and Jeffrey was very intelligent, very smart, and he knew enough not to go into the building. So he spoke to them outside. He sat on a wall, and they decided that he wasn't saying what he needed to say to get involuntarily committed. Later, we were to find out that they never called a psychiatrist or anybody that could have evaluated him that had the power to involuntarily commit him. So Jeffrey ended up coming back home. My daughters were crying. They called us up, and they said they're not going to take him in. And they have this all in the record. It said that the grandfather was pleading for his grandson to be admitted. So when they said they were bringing him home, we panicked, and we went in his room, and we took everything, his knives from Iraq, and his anything that we found, bottles of liquor. His car was disabled. We did whatever we thought to keep him safe. And my husband during this time also called the civilian authorities in our area, and they said they could do nothing because he was drinking. So in a crisis situation, there was nobody to turn to.
So they said they could do nothing because he was drinking. Is that a sign of PTSD as well?
Yes. No, this is the civilian authorities, not the VA.
And the VA, did they say he had to stop drinking in order to be treated?
They said that the very first time that they would not assess him for PTSD until he was alcohol-free.
So therefore, Jeff never got assessed for PTSD.
Can you talk about a therapist coming to the house, scheduled at least?
Well, I brought Jeff down to the vet center in Springfield on Main Street, and we had about a three-hour appointment. And Jeff invited me in for the assessment, so I was there when we were giving him information. And Jaime, who was the therapist assigned to work with Jeff, stated that what he was going to do is he was going to plan to come out to the house three times a week and look for some available resource, because there's very few beds for PTSD. So what happened was on Tuesday, from what we understand, Jaime called Jeff and did speak to Jeff Tuesday afternoon and got directions from Jeff to how to come to our house. And from what I understand, I believe that he left about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, but he got lost and he never made it to our house. I believe he found himself in Amherst at 7 o'clock in the evening, and that's when he decided to go back home.
In those last hours before he died, the day before, can you describe Jeffrey's behavior, Kevin? Describe Jeffrey crawling into your lap.
Well, Monday night when I got home, Jeffrey was in a total rage. He was pacing through the house. He was angry at the war, angry at everything. And I was trying to get him to calm down. And then he started talking of suicide. And he felt abandoned. He didn't know where to go. At that point, I called the vet center. And I told him what was going on. And the vet center was tremendous. They spoke to me, got me to calm down, because we were all distraught by this time. And then they spoke to Jeff. And substantially, Jeff was very calm after the phone call. They advised me to call the police if necessary. And what happened was that Jeff and I then started talking while I was doing some work. And then what happened with Jeff was, it was about 11:30 at night, and everything was I was exhausted. Jeff was exhausted, but he kept talking, and then finally asked me if he would be able to sit in my lap. And so 45 minutes we rocked in silence, and the therapist told us after Jeff died that that was no doubt his last place of refuge, his last safe harbor that he felt that he could go to. The next morning, I stayed up to about 2 or 3 o'clock until Jeff went to bed and he was calm. And then I got up, went to work. And then of course it was at 6:45 Tuesday evening that I came home.
And what happened when you came home?
I was talking on the cell phone to Joyce, and I said, Jeff, no doubt, I was laying in front of the TV. And so I told her I would call her back. So I went into the house, and I couldn't find Jeff. I went to his bedroom, and the one thing I noted was that his dog tags were laying on his bed. I then went out to the porch, to the deck. He wasn't there. And so then I went through the addition and I saw the cellar door open. Thus, I could see a light on and I caught some pictures that were laying on the floor, and in the center was his platoon picture. And I could see other pictures. So I went downstairs. My focus was on the pictures because I couldn't understand why they were there. When I went up to the pictures, the platoon picture had blood on it. The picture of each of his sisters were on each side of the platoon picture. And then there was pictures of the family in a half circle. Then I saw Jeff. And Jeff was, I thought, standing at first until I saw the hose double looped around his neck. I went running over there and I pushed Jeff up with my knees, and that was the last time he ever sat in my lap. I took the hose from around his neck and I laid him down onto the floor trying to make him comfortable. And at that point, I tried to rub his chest because I thought I felt some warmth there. Otherwise, he was very cold. And so then I went upstairs and called the police.
That was June 22nd, 2004?
Yes. It was Tuesday, June 22nd.
Did Jeffrey leave a suicide note?
Yes, he left a number of notes that were downstairs, and then we found notes afterwards. It appeared on June 22nd, he wrote a note that the police had taken. We didn't know about it until about a year after. And it's 4:35 p.m. and I am near completing my death. So that gave us a little bit more information to look at. But in the notes, he complained of being weak, how he loved his childhood, he did. But he said he couldn't put up with the pain anymore. And he really just thought that going out that way would be the best way for him to resolve.
Now, he mentions in the notes that he was hoping that...
Joyce.
I guess, it's Joyce, that he could have died a different way, that he didn't want to do it the way it happened, which goes back to maybe the car crash. And I remember mentioning to Jeffrey before he died that he was making me very nervous. I was really getting scared for his safety. And he said, don't worry, Ma, no matter what I do, I always come back. So he wanted to go out, but he didn't want it to be by his own hand. And he does say in the note that he thought long and hard about how it was going to affect the family. And he says, for that, I'm truly sorry.
In looking at the reports of the note, it said, also, I am weak and cannot deal with the emotional pain.
Yeah. Yep.
That, I think, was... There was a note that we found behind the TV several days after Jeffrey died when we were going through his room. And I believe that was something he was, like, almost like a draft, you know? And I look back and I think that maybe I interrupted him a couple of times because Jeff never locked his bedroom door. And there was a couple of times when I went to the door to see if he was okay that it was locked. And he said, oh, just a minute, Ma. And then he had me come in. And I'm thinking that I just might have interrupted him writing that because, like I said, it was put behind the TV.
So. Now, it's more than 3 years after that day, Tuesday, June 22nd, when Jeffrey killed himself. Mm-hmm. Why have you decided now to sue the Veterans Administration and the head, who's stepping down now, Jim Nicholson, the VA secretary?
There are so many reasons. First of all, it wasn't an easy decision for us to make. One of the most important reasons, though, is what happened to Jeffrey shouldn't have happened to anyone, never mind a veteran. And there's a number. We decided a long time ago that we couldn't make an objective decision about whether Jeff was treated right or wrong. And we went out seeking objectivity. And that was important to us because we just felt that things didn't make sense. Then we got records afterwards. One of the things you have to understand, we felt that we weren't treated right by the VA after Jeff died. We did call there about a week after, and we went to the VA. We got some records of Jeff's. And that just made us more curious, and we wanted to get the full records of Jeff. So I wrote under the Freedom of Information Act a request to get all his records. Well, then we started correspondence back and forth. I was being too broad in my request, what have you. And then finally, they sent us a Freedom of Information Act exemption. And that infuriated us. We couldn't understand why. And so that's when anger started really filtering in. And that's when we also found out about Jeff having revealed the three ways that he was going to commit suicide to himself, a number of factors. So and also their diagnosis of Jeff turned out to be alcohol dependency, mood disorder secondary to alcoholism. And I was infuriated that there was no mention of PTSD. There was no mention of the cause. So that just got us more angry. And then we met Attorney Boniface. And Attorney Boniface said that he would try to help us if he could. And so that's when a federal tort claim was laid. But then all of a sudden, we read in the Boston Globe an article by Charlie Sinnott, which reported the January 16th, 2007 suicide of Jonathan Schulze of Stuart, Minnesota. And that immediately infuriated us, that 2.5 years after our son died, after the VA had given us assurances through their inspector general that problems had been resolved and the chances of having another Jeffrey was small, it was all over again. And so at that point, we knew that this administration, the past Congresses, for sure, never have addressed this problem over the past few years. And there's only been very few voices asking for help for our veterans, with Senator Kerry being one. So at this point, we felt that we had to do something, because with each passing day, who else is putting a rope around their neck or a gun to their head? And it seems like no one cares.
Joyce and Kevin Lucey's son, Lance Corporal Jeffrey Lucey, committed suicide after returning from Iraq. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. We'll come back to the conclusion of this discussion in a minute.
Well, it's a morning like any other one, and I'm sleeping off despair of what my country's running from, what we're losing from our fear. And on this day a dream awakens me, and it wears the face of war. For this child who was always safe, I get to see what lies in store. And I am floating on the ocean, some kind of battle craft, and I am hiding in the blackness as the waves keep rolling back. And in the yet dark morning, oh, the soldiers hunt for me.
Greg Kelly, Dream of War, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we return to the last part of my interview with Joyce and Kevin Lucey. They're suing the Veterans Administration for negligence in the suicide of their son, Lance Corporal Jeffrey Lucey. I asked them about how they've dealt with their loss.
The group Military Families Speak Out was essential in giving us a reason to keep going. They're very supportive, and it really helped us during a time when we were in deep shock. It took us about 6 months to even be able to really understand that Jeffrey was never coming back. Our family has been very difficult. We have one daughter that is very vocal against this war of choice, against the lack of care that we feel that they were not prepared to give our veterans when they returned. And I have another child that is would prefer that this not be brought out in public and that we just stay at home, which is something that my husband and I felt we couldn't do. From the very beginning, we felt if we could help another family avoid what we went through, we felt we had to do that. You know, we just had no other choice. At the time, there was never any thought of a lawsuit or going where we are right now. But it's just been, we've taken one day at a time, and this is where we find ourselves right now. This is the way that we feel we can bring attention to the lack of care and the lack of planning in the care. I mean, they sent our boys out and women out, and they did not plan for their return.
Kevin, you yourself are a therapist?
Yes.
What kind of therapy do you do?
I work with sex offenders, rapists, and child molesters who are in the community.
And in dealing with this, as you deal with this over the years, has it changed your view of your community, of the military? Have other people reached out to you now, even in terms of learning from you dealing with someone who has come back from the war and suffering?
There's, I know this is going to sound strange, but there has been small blessings out of everything. First of all, as Joyce said, military families speak out, Gold Star families speak out. They have been enormously important in our lives. I think one of the biggest things that got destroyed in my mind was my perception of the American government. I couldn't believe, and I can't believe even till today, that the government would have never prepared for the soldiers upon their return home. It was more of an afterthought. And even now, even with all the money that they've been investing and all the Blue Star commissions, Blue Ribbon commissions, they aren't really dealing with what they need to deal with. Not one military family, I noticed, was ever appointed to any of the Blue Star commissions. And I thought that was a horrible slap in all of our faces. So right now, due to the fact that this administration and due to the fact that past Congresses haven't done anything, it's the phrase of the government by the people, for the people, by the people. I think we have to do something. We have other families who have joined with us. We have about 10 other families that we know that their loved ones committed suicide and it's been related to the war. And we were hoping to gather in Washington in June, but that wasn't able to be. But now we are seeing people standing with us, and there are so many other soldiers, other veterans have come to us. We have a young man, Eli, who we met in Washington, and he's a soldier. And he stated to us, please keep talking because we can't speak for ourselves. And so when you get the kind of reinforcement and kind of feedback like that, we're going to do this, no doubt, to the four corners of the earth and until the day we die.
Looking at some of the figures, the first quarter of 2006, the Department of Veterans Affairs, according to the California Nurses Association, treated over 20,000 Iraq vets for post-traumatic stress disorder with a backlog of 400,000 cases. And a returning soldier has to wait an average of 165 days for a VA decision on initial disability benefits. It's about half a year. Mm-hmm. How do those figures fit into your son's case? And there is another lawsuit that has been brought overall on these issues. Why did you decide not to join that lawsuit?
Are you talking of the class action suit by
Yes.
the veteran groups?
Yes.
Because in regards to a wrongful death suit, there are so many individual variables that are so specific to that incident that we couldn't join a class action suit. That's what our attorney had told us. Number two, we never knew that a class action suit was being brought forward by those veterans. And we can only applaud those veterans and the veterans organizations because at least they're trying to help their own while they're still breathing.
Is Jeffrey considered an Iraq war casualty?
No. No, he's not. If he had died over in Iraq, yes, he would be. But he came home and took his life here. So he's not a casualty, even though we know he is a casualty of that war.
He's unknown, uncounted, and unacknowledged by his government or by the nation.
How do you want him to be acknowledged, his life remembered?
I guess I'd like Jeffrey to be known as someone who wanted to help people. When he came back from Iraq, he said that's what he wanted to do now. He wanted to help. So through what we're trying to do, it's like Jeffrey's outreaching to help other people. And we're hoping that some good will come out of this lawsuit in the form of better health care for the veterans, and that would be I'm something that Jeffrey would be proud of.
And we want Jeff's legacy, and it's not only Jeff, we want to really emphasize that. We have people who have died the same way, T.J. Sweet, Philip Kent, Jason Cooper, and so many others, known and unknown. We want their legacy to be that they have saved others, that through the mistakes that the government had made with them, and through mistakes that we also made, that we all have learned and were able to come, especially in this country, with the most effective, the most responsive, viable VA healthcare system that can be afforded and that can be given to our veterans.
Do you think there's criminal liability here, that laws have been broken in dealing with these injured vets who are coming home?
We have to leave that up to a court. I'm not a lawyer. I don't have that kind of knowledge. In our souls, in our hearts, we believe what was done to Jeff was totally immoral, and it was not deserving of this country.
What would you tell other parents who are going through what you went through leading up to Jeffrey's suicide on June 22nd, 2004, how they should deal?
Well, I think with what we know now, at least what I know now, I would be much more proactive. I would be in their faces. I remember telling them that my son is slowly dying, and now that I look back, I'm thinking, well, you know, why wasn't I yelling it from the rooftops? Why wasn't I don't know where I would have gone, but they would have heard me. Somebody would have heard me. I don't think when you are actually going through it that you ever think that your child is going to die. You know, that's, if you really thought that, I know we were panicked. We panicked during that time. We were in crisis ourselves, but we never thought our child was going to die. Now I would just say, you know, you just get in their faces, and you have to demand them, whether you have to go to your senators or your representatives or whoever, you do whatever you have to get care for your child.
Was Jeffrey afraid of being dishonorably discharged if it came to be known that he was troubled?
Yes.
Yes.
He was afraid. That's what we were talking about, the stigma earlier. The fears that are created by the system itself and the fears that are created from within the person. He was afraid, number one, that he was letting down all the other men in his unit, that he was going to be a disappointment to the Marine Corps, that he was weak. And as you read from his letter, Amy, I think the weakness was the final straw. See, with PTSD, it's a psychological journey that unless you've experienced it, you never know how it goes. And that's one of the most tragic things about all this, and that there are so many others dealing with PTSD, and people will erroneously just look at the alcohol, will look at the drug addiction, and not look at the shattered spirit. So.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Is there anything else that you'd like to add as we wrap up this conversation today?
I, for one, would just plead for the people to finally demand from the government to really take care of our troops. We've heard so many politicians, we've heard people from the administration get up and tell us how much they support the troops. And we get so infuriated and so angry when we hear that, because we also know that a year ago, they deleted $80 million from a budget for specifically the treatment of PTSD. It never made it out of conference committee. And if that's the way they support the troops, then we need to do something about Congress, because they certainly have let so many men and women down.
I have one last question. There was an investigation into what your son claimed, what Jeffrey said about being forced to shoot these two Iraqis. Military said that his claim wasn't true. What have you come to believe about that situation?
Well, I think we've always believed Jeffrey, and in light of so many stories coming out since we first came out with what Jeffrey said, it makes Jeffrey's situation more believable, at least to us. And as parents, it really, to us, didn't make a difference what caused Jeffrey's PTSD. We know that he came back different, so something happened to him over there.
And the most important thing from our perspective is that in regards to Jeff, I just lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
Well, I had asked about the findings by the military, a Captain Pat Kerr saying the claim he was forced to shoot unarmed Iraqi soldiers was without merit.
Well, I think one of the things, and I said this caution immediately, I said an agency investigating itself, I have a lot of problems with that. Independence is an issue. So, but as Joyce said, and I can only echo Joyce, we fully believe our son. We will stand by our son. And this is why we are here now.
If I could add, when we look back at his letters, he did write something to the effect of in April that he had he would like to erase the last month of his life, that he felt he had done immoral things. And we can't possibly believe that he was planning on making up stories, so he was writing this kind of thing in his letters. And if you understand what I'm trying to say, but this was way back when he was over in Iraq and his letters were coming home. And he said that he had seen and done enough horrible things to last him a lifetime. So he wasn't specific, but all these little things put together also make us believe that what Jeffrey was telling us was probably the truth.
And the greatest testimony to Jeff lies over at Island Pond Cemetery, his grave.
What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that Jeff felt an overwhelming guilt in regards to whatever happened over there. And Jeff shared the stories only with very few. He never really went beyond the family except for the professionals that were involved. And he never bragged. And his statements were always consistent. There wasn't any change. If a person is lying or bragging, it's never going to be consistent. There's always going to be some facts that have changed. In regards to Jeff, they didn't. So at this point, by the very virtue, he felt so horrible that the only way he could escape the pain was through his own self-inflicted death. I think that gives the greatest testimony.
Kevin and Joyce Lucy. Their son, Lance Corporal Jeffrey Lucy, committed suicide after returning from Iraq. Pentagon figures show at least 116 active duty suicides in Iraq. That figure doesn't include dozens more under investigation, nor those who took their lives after returning home like Jeffrey. That number could have grown last week. On Friday, 23-year-old Noah Charles Pierce was found dead in northern Minnesota. Police are calling his death an apparent suicide. Charles Pierce had been diagnosed with PTSD after returning from Iraq. If you'd like a copy of today's show, go to our website at democracynow.org. And a fond farewell to John Hamilton, producer extraordinaire, for your creativity, skill, and intelligence. John, I wish you the very best together with your new wife, Maddie Harper, our first Democracy Now! Wedding. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.